This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with the great Norwegian novelist Per Pedersen.
I suddenly thought, I have to do what they do. I mean, do something that affects people, readers, the way they affect me. And I thought that if I can't do that, I will be a very unhappy person.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Susan Casey tells us about rogue waves.
It steepens and it steepens and it steepens and it's feathering off the top. And then it advances like a vertical wall. That was truly the most terrifying thing I had ever seen.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news.
This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features 911 assist to give you peace of mind. If your airbag deploys, Sync automatically calls 911 using your cell phone and immediately puts you in contact with a 911 operator. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
With the publication a few years ago of his novel Outstealing Horses, the Norwegian novelist Per Pedersen emerged as one of the world's great writers. He has a new book. It's called I Curse the River of Time. Per Pedersen recently came to the Times, and we talked about his career as a writer.
Well, you must be the envy of just about every novelist because you do what all novelists think they can do, which is to describe very ordinary lives in a quiet way, and to bring your characters to life in with very subtle prose. Your subjects are memory and the past and loss. How are you able to do that when other writers can't?
For the first, ordinary lives are the only lives I know, so that's not so special. Well, I wanted to be a writer as a very young man, and among the few books that I read when I was like 18, In one week, I read the Nick Adams stories from Hemingway, and I was so astonished that he could, in so few lines, do so much with my feelings. And I also read Per Lagerkvist from Sweden and a Norwegian writer that you wouldn't know, and it just said click. I suddenly thought, I have to do what they do. I mean, do something that affects people, readers, the way they affect me. And I thought that if I can't do that, I will be a very unhappy person in my life. So I decided that I had to be a writer. But I was very afraid of not being good. So then I didn't write much, of course, because the potential of the unfinished is much better than, you know, the littleness of the finished, I thought. So I just went on waiting for myself. And it took me 17 years to finish a short story. I didn't have the confidence, and I didn't find my language for a very long time. I was trying to write in the 70s, a radical decade in Norway, and a lot of very good writers, very radical, kind of writing the big Norwegian novel. And so I would do that too, I thought, but I couldn't. And I was a radical. And then we came to the 80s, that was not so radical, and then suddenly there was room for me.
Well, that brings us up to I Curse the River of Time, which deals with radicalism. It's set in 1989. It's really the end of communism, and the narrator, character that readers of your work will be familiar with, he's appeared in other books, Arvid Johnson, is remembering his own days as a communist. What about your own politics?
It's perhaps a little difficult for Americans to understand how radical the 70s was in Norway. This very nice country, not very poor, today very rich, and strong trade union movement, you know, social welfare, very good. And at the same time, so many young people turn in to be kind of a Maoist or close to Maoist thinking and join the party that was like that. And I wouldn't say it was average, but it was typical. I mean, if you write about a young person from the 70s, you very quickly stumbles upon this radical movement. So this is not really a book about communism. It's a book about Arvid Johnson, for time being part of this movement because it sort of feels right for him.
Another theme that runs through the novel and maybe connects with this idea of radicalism in what would seem a happy land, Norway, is the idea of the angry young man, Alan Sillitoe's novel that was then made a film, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, which is discussed in the novel. What were you, Arvid, and people like him angry about exactly?
I can tell you, it all started, as here maybe, with the Vietnam War. Because, in fact, America was very important, both like, you know, the race conflict in the United States and the Vietnam War, and also, you know, apartheid in South Africa. These were issues that were very important to us. And we were angry about that. We were angry about seeing, you know, napalm bombing in Vietnam. And there was a great movement for peace in Vietnam. And what was a little more angry than that was that part of this movement said, not peace in Vietnam, they said victory to the FNL, that they should beat the Americans out of Vietnam. So that sort of changed it a little and made it more radical. So we were angry about that.
And yet, one of the great qualities in your work is the interior life that you describe. We don't want listeners to think that you're writing about agitators who were shouting slogans.
Not at all. I mean, on the contrary.
What you capture with this unerring exactitude is the relationships between parents and children, and also how over time and through memory they begin to change meanings for ordinary people. And as you say, that's who most of us are. Where did you find the language to do that? Is that what took you so long to mature as a writer?
I guess so. When the 80s started, I tried to finish a story. My wife and my daughter, they went away for a vacation for 1 week, and I said to myself, this is your chance. You have to write a short story this week or you're finished.
And what were you doing then? How were you earning your living then?
I was working in a bookshop. Oh, yeah. Very good bookshop. Best there is.
Right.
Well, I sat down rather unhappy to write this story because I knew this was a crucial week. I really couldn't wait any longer to, you know, to prove to myself that I perhaps could write. And so what I started to write was this very simple short story about Arvid Jansen and his working class family and the conflicts and the feelings he had as a 7-year-old boy when things really, in the grown-up world, is a very dangerous world, of course, to a child. And how he reacts to this and how it influences him and without him really knowing why. I wrote that story in that week and I sent it into a magazine and they took it and they asked for more. And I said, of course I have more, but I didn't have more. So I wrote another one and suddenly it like, you know, 12 stories in a year, which is very good for me. And there was a book. And this was a very simple story about Arvid Jansen.
Per, the new novel, I Curse the River of Time, is set in 1989, and in the life of the hero, Arvid Jansen, several important things are happening at once.
He's heading for a divorce that he does not like to think about. He really feels desperate about it, but he has no way of dealing with it without despairing. At the same time, his mother is diagnosed with cancer, a mother that he's really always sort of struggled to come in contact with, to be loved by, and he suspects that he is not loved, and so his mother now is very ill and may die, and this is kind of a desperate time for him because when will she love me if she dies? He's kind of desperate about that. At the same time, it's 1989, and big things happen. You know, the wall tumbles in Europe, the Soviet Union is crumbling. And at the same time, you have all these incidents in Beijing, China, you know, the Tiananmen Square, where they killed the students that were demonstrating.
And Arvid had been a Maoist.
And he had. But for me, I chose the year 1989 just because it was the year before my mother died. I sort of, as an old-time radical, I forgot about, you know, the politics, the communism, the China, everything. So it just dawned on me, and I had written like 30 pages or something, hey, this is 1989. When important things come up and I'm not sort of prepared for it yet, I just say, don't think about it. It will come.
You've said you write sentence by sentence.
I do.
What does that mean? You don't know where you're going when you begin?
Definitely not. If I could plot a novel, I think I would because it sounds, in a way, easier. I mean, if you fall out of the book kind of and for a time like going to New York and talk about books and you fall out of the writing and then you come back and you just sort of follow the plot that you already plotted. But I can't do that, so I'll use a lot of time to get in the mood to find out what was the last sentence, why did I feel so strongly about it. And sometimes I have to wait, you know, for months to kind of come in the mood again. So the previous sentence is very, very important for me. And basically, I don't know what I'm going to write when I go up down to work in the morning, which is scary and also very satisfying.
And so how do you deal now with your celebrity and fame? You pretty much live far away from population centers, right?
I live out in the forest, small farm in the forest, and you can't even have a beer without buying it then at the shops, but you can't go out and have a beer with the boys. That would mean going into Oslo in a taxi would cost like 2,000 kroner or something, which is a lot. So... Yes, pretty solitary. I like it, and I also don't like it because I want to talk to people too, of course. My dog is very nice, but not much response. We walk together. You know. So I like it. I'm a city boy, really, but I moved out to get the girl, which we often do, and it's nice.
Thanks so much, Per Patterson.
Thank you.
It's Per Patterson, whose new novel, I Curse the River of Time, is reviewed in the New York Times Book Review.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet by David Mitchell. Chosen as an Amazon Best Book of the Month, Mitchell's tale of an illicit turn-of-the-century romance will not disappoint fans of his intelligent, highly stylized narrative. That's The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet by David Mitchell, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Sam.
So, Julie, Jonathan Franzen and Oprah Winfrey together again?
Yes. Oprah is announcing that she has chosen Freedom, Jonathan Franzen's novel, as her latest book club pick.
Is this a surprise in the publishing world?
Not exactly. Booksellers, when they order an Oprah book, have to fill out a form saying, of course, that they will not reveal the title, that they won't sell it early. But they are given some information that has been very vital clues in figuring out this Oprah pick. They were told that it is a Macmillan book, which is Franzen's publisher.
That's the big publisher that, with several imprints, one of them being Farrar, Straus & Schulz.
Yes. And they were also told that it was a $28 hardcover, which also narrows it down considerably. So there were a lot of booksellers who have said, I knew this on August 30th, the day before the book came out. But signs of proof actually only happened this week when Dennis Johnson, the publisher of Melville House, a small publisher in Brooklyn, wrote on his blog that he knew from a reliable source that it was Freedom. And then yesterday, he supplied an image of the cover of Freedom affixed with the little Oprah Book Club sticker.
So do we know if the novelist, Jonathan Franzen, and Oprah have actually sort of made up personally? Or was it never really between the two of them?
Well,
because it was a controversy when the corrections came out. And remind us what that was all about.
So this all happened about 9 years ago. The corrections was chosen as an Oprah Book Club pick. And after it was chosen, Franzen went around, made a lot of public comments that Oprah found to be disparaging, among them that the Oprah Book Club pick could be a turnoff to male readers. And also he made some comments about Oprah's book club picks. While he said that some of them were good, he also said that some of them were schmaltzy and one-dimensional.
And at that point, Oprah actually kind of withdrew the corrections as her selection. Is that right?
That's right. And Franzen was about to make an appearance on Oprah's show, and Oprah uninvited him from that appearance.
So what will happen now? Will Franzen appear in the program? Do we know? Is that part
of
the
package? We don't know yet. We know that, of course, he, in the years since the original feud, Franzen apologized over and over again. He said that his comments were taken out of context. But he's made comments recently. He spoke to the Minneapolis Star Tribune a few weeks ago, and he was asked by the reporter, if Oprah chose your book, what would you think? And he said that he would be very happy if she did. So he seems to have opened the door to that.
Well, and this is our number one bestseller. So this means increased and prolonged sales, most likely, right?
Yes. I mean, among the books on the market right now that needed a boost in sales, Freedom is probably not it. But I'm sure that it will sell many more books because of this pick. And a bookseller I talked to a little while ago said that another clue that he was receiving that it was the book club pick is that the publisher was very reluctant to give them a lot of reprints when they tried to place more orders for the book. So he suspected at the time, okay, they must have about 500,000 copies sitting in a warehouse somewhere with the Oprah book club sticker.
Now, Julie, we heard from some women novelists, some of them quite successful commercially, who objected to the amount of attention and publicity Jonathan Franzen was getting from what they sometimes indicated or implied was a male literary establishment. What happens now that Oprah Winfrey has embraced, as it were, Jonathan Franzen? Have we heard any reaction from them?
I haven't seen any reaction yet. I'll have to tune into Jodi Picoult's Twitter feed to find out. But it's going to be tough to argue with this one.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features 911 Assist. If ever your airbag deploys, Sync automatically calls 911 using your cell phone. Bypassing call centers, you're immediately put in contact with a 911 operator. And Sync will even deliver an urgent message to the emergency operator if you're unable to respond. That's peace of mind made possible by Sync. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
There is a monster in our midst, and it keeps getting bigger, and we're finally starting to learn something about it. They are waves. There's a new book. It's called The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. It's by distinguished author Susan Casey, who's also the editor-in-chief of O Magazine. It's reviewed for us this week by Holly Morris, who says Casey has written a convincing and entertaining tale with a vivid kinetic narrative. Delighted that Susan Casey's here to talk about her book. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
Susan, what is a rogue wave?
Well, from a scientific definition, it's a wave that's at least two times as big as the surrounding sea. So you could get a 75-foot wave, rogue wave, in 25-foot seas.
And where are they? All over the planet?
They are. And they can occur in different conditions, and small and large and medium and everything else. But there are several places on the planet that specialize in kicking up rogue waves. The North Sea, the North Atlantic in winter, the southeast coast of Africa. There's a number of different things that make it more hazardous, the water there, and as well as the area around Antarctica, of course, famously stormy.
Well, and weren't sailors and ships captains reporting seeing these enormous waves, and they weren't believed?
Yeah, it's the classic big fish tale. It's like, yes, I saw a 100-foot wave, and it really damaged the boat. It's like, yeah, sure you did. The laws of linear physics and what we believe to be the rules of the ocean didn't allow for them. But really, the bottom line on that is that we don't really know how the ocean works. And the rules that we set up are actually not the rules it plays by. And it was only when they started getting laser measurements on oil platforms that, yeah, you know, you can have an 85-foot wave pop out of 32-foot seas. You know, you can have a wave that's three times or four times as big as the surrounding seas, and it's not up for discussion. This is happening, and now we've proved it. So then scientists had to go back to the drawing board and start using, you know, nonlinear physics, random, you know, chaos theory, quantum physics, and they still don't really understand how this happens.
Well, and you don't write just about scientists. Where there are waves, there must be surfers, right? What are tow surfers?
Tow surfers are to surfers what astronauts are to pilots. You know, it's a whole different sport. They had actually invented their sport, and they needed to, because to surf the biggest waves that the ocean can generate, which is the stated intention of one of the main characters in the book, Laird Hamilton, they needed a whole different set of equipment. They needed a whole different means to get on the waves, because anything over 40 feet is just moving too fast for a human being to catch it.
Right, you can't just paddle out.
Right. Now, I liken that to trying to catch the subway by crawling. You know, at a certain point, you're just not going to make it. And so Laird and his buddies basically, you know, in Laird's garage, came up with this new sport that's really only, again, about 15 years old, that can get them on top of a 100 or 200-foot wave using jet skis and water ski ropes and, you know, smaller, heavier surfboards with foot straps. And as you can imagine, like, learning how to do that sport, is the price is pretty high.
All right, Susan, we have these monster waves, these rogue waves, and we have these daredevil surfers who actually ride them. What happens when they fall?
That was really a fundamental question I wanted to answer in the book, because when I saw the pictures, I couldn't believe anybody could survive a fall. And I know what a 6-foot wave can do to you. So I was very curious, and I started asking them. And what happens is you fall, and the power is so immense that you're immediately driven down about 30 feet. And they're wearing these sort of very dense life jackets that pop them up to the surface. But, you know, their eardrums sometimes blow out, and there's white water across the top that blocks out all the light. So your eardrums are burst, you're upside down, you don't know if you're right side up, you're going to be held down there for quite a long time in what is essentially an underwater bomb blast. And what I kept hearing over and over again was, you have to relax. You have to relax down there. You're not going to fight the wave. These forces are so much more powerful than anything we could ever muscle our way through, that is the only way they can survive, is by relaxing in the middle of this underwater bomb blast and then tucking themselves in to make sure their limbs don't get torn off or their necks don't get snapped. Then there will be a point where the wave energy kind of releases before the next wave comes, and that's when they hope to get to the surface. And then their partner, if all goes well, on a jet ski is going to zoom in, get them, and whip out of there before the next 70-foot wave come down on the jet ski and the surfer in the water. So it's really a harrowing thing, and especially so because these jet skis fail a lot. So they go into this white water, this aerated water that comes up when the wave slams down, and sometimes the white waters are 30 and 40 feet high. The impeller of the jet ski sucks in the air. It doesn't get any water, and it stops. So all of a sudden, they're just, as I said, like instead of a rescue machine, they've got a 1,000-pound problem. And not only that, when the wave hits, the jet ski could smash into them, which happens. So it's a pretty precarious sport, not for the faint-hearted.
Now, when you're following someone like Laird Hamilton around, I mean, this is a real kind of Evel Knievel, daredevil type guy. How do you do that? Does he just notify you that he's off to surf somewhere and then you're in a plane flying out to meet him, or were you actually traveling around with him?
I lived in Hawaii next door to him for several years while I was writing this book, and really just kind of became part of their world. My background, I have a water sports background as well, not surfing. I was a competitive swimmer, still am. So I felt that was a unique qualification to write this book, because I was able to go out in these really volatile ocean conditions and not completely freak out, you know, which I think would have been very challenging if it wasn't for, you know, that I'm actually more comfortable on water than I am on land.
Oh, so you were a competitive swimmer? You still are?
Yeah, I just do open water ocean races.
What's the tallest wave you've seen?
About 72, 73 feet.
Where was that?
That was off the coast of Baja, California, at a surf break called Killers. And it was an extremely memorable experience, because when a wave gets over 60 feet tall, it starts doing something different. It doesn't just kind of rise up and crest and break like we think of a wave. It comes up and it steepens and it steepens and it steepens, and it's feathering off the top. And then it advances like a vertical wall for a minute or two. So it's like this got this amazingly pregnant with violence, you know, hang time before it then starts to break. And that was truly the most terrifying thing I had ever seen.
Now, let's set this up. Where were you exactly? You were at...
I was on a boat.
You were on a boat. And how distant was this wave when you saw it cresting or rising?
It wasn't very distant. I was probably within 200 or 300 yards of it, because when at the surf breaks, these giant waves are caused by reef formations on the bottom. That's one kind of giant wave. And I describe it in the book as it's like a runaway Mack truck hitting a ramp, and the ramp is the reef, and the Mack truck is the swell energy that comes from big storms, in this case a storm that brewed in the Gulf of Alaska and then came down the west coast and kept going. And I was with a band of surfers, big wave surfers, that were chasing it from Northern California down to Todos Santos Island, which is off the coast of Ensenada. What happens when it's next to a reef is there's a channel. So theoretically, there's a zone where the wave will not break, although every so often a boat will get taken out when the wave shifts direction or something like that. But so I was sitting on a boat in the channel next to that wave, and you know, all the waves that day were around the 50-foot range, and all of a sudden this thing, it was like an eagle, you know, coming, screaming through. It was so much bigger than the other waves. And I, up until that point, had been very respectful and awed at times and had seen some very, very big and very powerful waves, but nothing, when I saw that, that changed my perspective.
Were there not so many rogue waves or waves of such dimension, say, 30 or 40 years ago? I mean, is this the result of some change in the atmosphere or the climate, or don't we know?
We don't know, but I think these waves are a timeless feature of the ocean. The one thing that I definitely discovered as I was reporting my book was that scientists think that climate change is creating more extremes. So, in other words, if we have a storm, it could be a lot bigger. We definitely are having rising sea levels. So, despite the complexity of climate change and despite all the questions that remain unanswered about its effects, one thing I really feel strongly about after interviewing all these scientists is we're in for a very restless bunch of water on our planet.
Thanks a lot, Susan.
Thank you.
That's Susan Casey, whose new book, The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean, is reviewed in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
So Swedish Americans are feeling pretty good right about now?
We are, Sam. We are. Jonathan Franzen, Son of St. Louis, enters at number one on the fiction list with Freedom. He knocks Stieg Larsson, the old world Swede, down to number two. It'll be really interesting to see how long Franzen can hold him off. And in kind of a nice symmetry. So Franzen's novel, as I think you read the book, so you may know this, it's about a family of Midwestern liberals during the Bush years. And he's sort of facing off against the number one book on the nonfiction list, or staring eye to eye. That book is David Limbaugh's Crimes Against Liberty. And David Limbaugh, brother of Rush, is a Midwestern non-liberal. So I think we've got a nice little politically polarized moment on top of the bestseller list this week.
Right, sort of the Battle of the Heartland.
Yeah.
Franzen's number one now. It's a very crowded upper bracket in the list. How long can he stay on the bestseller list, do you think?
That'll be really interesting to see. I mean, the correction spent 29 weeks on the hardcover list, sold 2.7 million copies. Of course, he got a big assist from Oprah on that one. But this time out, he's got Barack Obama in his corner. You know, you remember Obama was reading the book even before it came out. And the sales, according to the publisher, have been really huge up front. So interesting to see if he sort of gets all of his readers in the early weeks, as opposed to building, as the corrections did.
And what about the rest of the list?
Well, there are a couple of new titles on the fiction list, mostly sort of classic summer reading stuff. You've got Clive Cussler, Sarah Paretsky, Jennifer Cruzy. A couple of new books on the nonfiction list, starting with Tony Blair. He enters at number three with his memoir, A Journey. Interestingly, a different Englishman with a new book has been really grabbing all the headlines lately. You know, Tony Blair is getting pelted with shoes and tomatoes at he had to cancel his book party. Lots of protesters coming out. But in the meantime, Stephen Hawking is out there talking to God, or rather blowing off God. He made headlines recently when excerpts from his new book, The Grand Design, just published, not yet on the list. The excerpts revealed that now Hawking has suddenly decided that God was not necessary for the Big Bang, and this got a lot of headlines.
Did he used to think God had been?
Yeah, so in A Brief History of Time, his monster bestseller from about 20 years ago, I believe it was the last sentence of the book said that understanding the laws of the universe would allow us to see the mind of God. And, you know, maybe this was a metaphor, maybe not, but it aroused quite a great deal of interest that this time around, Hawking doesn't think God's around to have a mind.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.